I was single at the time, and her and I just started seeing one another, so it was a bit of a biggie really. It was either we split up, and either we don't go to Manchester and we carry on, or I go to Manchester and we split up, or we have to take the plunge right now, because if you do something like that and move as two single people, but you're dating to, you know, 300 miles from home, you're making a fairly big statement about what your intentions are. So, so we moved and we had to do the whole thing of living in separate houses, obviously, where anyone gets them an idea. And so she lived on one street, I lived on the next street, we were housemates and all that stuff. And we got married in 2002, which was 2 years after we moved. And then we had our first child in 2005.
Very good.
Yeah.
Is that it?
No, we've got two. We've got a little girl, and the boy's called Joel, and he's one, he's 2.5, and Jaya is 6 months old. Great, I'll talk about that a bit later.
Splendid stuff, that's really good. So, what's your, they're obviously quite young, but what's your earliest memory?
My earliest memory? Rusty. I remember throwing a bit of a hippie fit one time when my mum wanted to take a photograph of me in the park and I didn't want to have my photo taken. Not extremely interesting, but there is now a photograph in the family album of me with like the red face and puffy eyes because I don't have a complete fit about that.
I've got one like that where I was wearing a kilt. You weren't wearing a kilt.
No.
Okay, that's fine. No, just wondered.
I did wonder on the way up here whether I needed to.
It probably could be arranged then, but you got a kilt. So that's your earliest memory, but kind of staying with the childhood thing, what was your favourite toy when you were...
I loved an Action Man. I had an Action Man helicopter, which was great, because gemstone eyes. See, nowadays you can get loads of different Action Man. Have you noticed that? You probably don't go into toy shops, but I do a lot. But you get lots of different ones. Back then, it was just you had the one with the straight eyes, or the one with the bobby eyes, didn't you?
Eagle eyes.
And you could squeeze the button on the back of the thing to make the blades go, which is quite dangerous.
Then you had kind of wobbly eyes yourself.
That's
good. But what's nowadays? If you were to say, that was your favourite thing, what's your favourite thing?
I'm a big lover of sport. I love playing sport, love football and all that stuff. I do have a bit of a love of kiting. Kites, the things on strength that fly in the sky.
Yeah.
I have a big one of those. Mm-hmm. But it's been in the boot of the car for quite a while because kids arriving and all that stuff. So hopefully with the winds as they're going to be in the next few weeks, we'll get out of
it. Serious kind of Japanese cut the enemy up kind of.
Yeah, it's fairly big. The one I've got wouldn't lift me off the ground anyway. It might lift someone who doesn't weigh as much as me off the ground.
What's your favourite song?
Oh, my favourite song? Oh, my word. All I've got is like children's TV.
Yeah, I've been there.
Oh, my goodness. Favourite song? Oh, do you know, I'm a big lover of Delirious, and that's a bit sort of old hat, but I love their song, Majesty, which is, I think, on the album World Service. I really love that. That sounds terribly uncool and Christian, I know. I'm just desperately trying to think of something else that I really, really like.
What about film then?
Films? Oh man, I should have asked you what you're going to ask now, I would have thought about these things. I love... I'm going to say one's a load of swearing and everyone's going to
get a load of swearing.
Something by Disney, I'm sure. I really love a film called Layer Cake, which don't watch if you are of a nervous disposition or you don't like swearing in films, have a load of swearing. But I really like that film. I think it's quite funny, it's quite deep, and it talks about the culture that I'm quite interested in. It's like that drug trafficking, really.
What's your most embarrassing thing?
Oh, do you know, I had one of these recently, it is quite embarrassing. Our daughter was in hospital just after she was born, and she was in hospital for 2 weeks, and very, very stressful time because I had Joel at home and Hannah was in hospital with JSO. It was just an awful, awful time, and she's very ill, but she's fine now. But what I would do every day, because we were eating, he and I were doing proper lads things at home, we were eating badly, we were watching trash TV till late at night together, doing lads stuff, you know. And so I thought my exercise each day when we went to the hospital would be to pick him up and to carry him up the stairs, because we're on like the sixth floor or something. So I did that every day. I thought, that's a good bit of exercise, that's work up a sweat. And so I did that every day, and so I got used to doing it every day. And on about the eighth or ninth day, I sort of was trotting down the stairs, shall we say. And I got to the bottom, to the door, where, the door's a bit like that door over there, has a pad on it. So when you get to it, you push the pad, which is, of course, at chest height. And as I went to push the door, it opened before me, and a nurse was standing at the door, and I ran pretty much straight into her with my hands on her breast. There you go, that's an embarrassing moment. That's pretty good, I have to say. Don't try this at home.
Going from the nurse. Yes. Obviously saw the ridiculous to the sublime.
And it comes to faith. I came to faith when I was 12, and then again when I was 14, and then again when I was 16, and 17, and 19, 23, and pretty much every day since. But what I would point to as my main conversion experience was really through a friend of mine who just came to me one day and said, you know what, I've discovered the most important thing in life is Jesus. And I said to him, yeah, we kind of know that. We go to church, I grew up in church. He said, no, but really, actually, Jesus is really, really important in all this stuff. It's not about the activity. It's not about the friends. It's not about the fun or the music or whatever you're into. It's not about that stuff. It's actually about Jesus. And we sort of had an important relationship, he and I, over about a period of a year before he went to university. And we learned a lot of time learning together what it meant to be followers of Jesus. Mm-hmm. And so it's around that kind of time, yeah. Really. I mean, I could give you a day and an hour, but we'd probably do the whole process in justice, really.
Yeah. It's good. And you've said it's an ongoing thing. What's probably the greatest lesson you've learned in that time in your faith journey?
The greatest lesson I've learned, I suppose it would be. There's a few things, aren't there? Things I've learned about me. I've learned that I am not very good at being a Christian, being the person that God would like me to be. And my biggest disappointment is always me and my own capacity to cock it up. Okay? Things I learned about God is he doesn't really mind that much. And however much I cock it up, he's okay with that, and he'll continue to use us and love us and look after us and that kind of stuff. Things I've learned about mission and what we're called to do is that actually all of this stuff, the singing and all that, which is great by the way, thanks to the band, it's fantastic. Singing and praying, even studying the Bible and the kind of intimacy stuff that we crave in church is only of any value if it comes out of a life of action and doing stuff in the world. Relates to justice and relates to the marginalised and relates to people that are on their backside and can't get up. And unless we're going out and helping people to stand up, then that's the biggest thing I've learned about what we're meant to do is do something, not just what we do on Sundays.
Okay,
a few answers.
That's good. Yeah, thanks for that. I know some of the guys here will ask you some questions about that. So now I'll ask you one more question, and then I'll throw it over to you guys to ask Gary questions about some of the stuff that he's been doing. And if anybody's read this, you might want to ask some questions about it. If you haven't read it, it might answer some of your questions, and it's well worth buying.
I'm sure Ivan's got a couple of stock plans.
we're still on
£8. Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. Well, fortunately, I spent a fortune going to Roos and got mine for £7, so... haven't seen the one from DHQ, but maybe because he knows I've got this. So either that or I don't read my mail, which is probably more accurate. So please feel free to jump in and ask loads of questions. My last question would be, how does God make you stay away? What does God do to make you say wow?
How does God make me say wow, goodness? Well, I meet God, personally for me, meeting God is generally involves people who are disciples or who aren't even disciples, and I somehow meet God in people, and I see him looking back from all kinds of different people, really, and I just think, wow, God is in that person, because we're all created in the image of God, and that gets a bit broken down sometimes, regularly that gets a bit broken and damaged, but that is generally, I would say personally, I know this isn't true for everyone, I feel like I meet with God mostly through people, more so than, say, through prayer and worship, or some people would say that's the way they really meet with God, and that's why I'm not saying that's wrong or anything like that, I'm just saying for me, generally the most striking things that have happened to me, the most deeply spiritual moving moments have been with people.
Gary, incarnational living.
Yeah.
Not really a 9-to-5 job.
Yeah.
How do you switch off? Do you?
You don't really. Just to put me in the picture, I was the leader of this project in Openshaw. I started it in 2000 and I stopped leading it in February. So I do now have effectively a 9-to-5 job, really. I do the same thing as Jim. Is that what you'd like to be called? Jim. I do the same job as Jennifer now. So I do have a bit of a 9-to-5 now. I still live in Openshaw in the community. And so, life sort of just rolls on. I would say it is a very, very big challenge. And it's more about, for me, switching off. Sometimes you have to go places other than where we live in order to switch off. And sometimes you have to learn coping mechanisms of ways of keeping yourself alive and keeping yourself fresh. And I don't mean just like having great long quiet times in order to keep yourself spiritually fresh. I mean getting good exercise, eating well, sleeping well, getting out and stimulating your brain with good stuff, that is, whether it's filmed or cinema or stuff like that, and trying to be really disciplined about your spirituality, although even that becomes quite difficult in the grind of living and working and ministering in one little community. It's a good question. I'm not sure I have a really good answer, other than you have to, every single person will be different. So for me, one of the things was sleep. For the first 3 years of living in Openshaw, I always tried every night to sleep 8 hours. That was like one thing for me. So if we had an early morning prayer meeting, which we did every single week, I'd have to go to bed early. But on Tuesday nights, go to bed early. So I'm in bed at 9:45 so that I can have 8 hours before getting up and being ready for prayer meeting.
Jesus, who would you say is an influence in your life? Is that something that you point to?
Lots and lots of people. Huge influence on people from just from my life, friends and people that have spoken into my life. In terms of big name people, if that's a question. People like Jacob Pullinger, who wrote the book Chasing the Dragon, which was just after Hannah and I got married, we went on holiday, honeymoon, and we read Chasing the Dragon, which is probably a silly thing to do on honeymoon, because it blows your mind, actually, to read about her exploits in Hong Kong. And we came back changed from that, and that's influenced our lives since. More recently, in terms of books and stuff like that, Shane Claiborne, who wrote Irresistible Revolution, which is only just recently out. It's just, at the moment I am just trying to process everything that's in that book. So if you're You know, if you're thinking about or interested in doing something like Eden or Neil or whatever you decide to call it, or even to just sort of think about living in communities together, getting teams of people together or planting churches or whatever, but that book particularly I think is well worth a look, Irresistible Revolution. Other than that, lots of individuals along the way, and I think that part of our spiritual journey, as I sort of alluded to in terms of meeting God through people, is those people that are walking into your life and have conversations with you and have coffee with you and come around for a meal, and really you invest in one another. And I think there'll be lots of those. Probably would feel wrong to name lots of people because you might know people, but I miss others out. So, but yeah, just people really. I expected it to be really hard, and I expected it to be quite torturous, to be honest. I thought that I would do it, and I'd just do it, and, you know, like when you take medicine, I'll just do it, and it'll be done, and I'll eat something nice afterwards, and it'll be better. It sounds terrible now, because that really hasn't been my experience at all. And I won't sort of hide the fact that I was pretty scared first when I moved there. It's great to have Tommy with us. Tommy was my next door neighbour for a whole load of years, and we just moved house about 300 yards, didn't we? So not very far. Just across the road, because they're pulling all the old houses down. But, you know, the street where we lived, you know, I saw some fairly horrible things happen on that street. And like the first week I lived there, I saw someone chase down the road with a carving knife. Like literally, like psycho. I'm like, man, what am I doing here? And I also saw a couple. There's a terrorist street somewhere with alleyways at the back. I don't know if you call them ginnels, but we have ginnels at the back of the house. And I saw someone drive a car down the alleyway at the back of back of the house. The sparks flying off the sides, and they're like wheelie bins just going flying, aren't they? And I was looking out the back window, thinking, what the heck am I doing here? I don't know. But those stories are sort of kind of, they're things that happen and you kind of get used to it. And but the majority of the time, it's not like that. It's really good, and you meet lots of people who are very friendly, very, we've got, you know, we just know loads of people. I don't know what it's like in Scotland, but, you know, in the south, you basically don't know your neighbours, you know. So my parents, they live in a suburb, and they might know the name of the neighbours one side. Then they know what the other people look like on the other side, but they don't actually know anybody else in their entire area. Move to somewhere like Manchester, and I reckon it's probably the same up here. You kind of know people around places. You know all the people on your street, and so you just get to know people. And partly because you have no space at the back of your house, everyone hangs out at the front of the house. You know, in the street, the kids play in the street, the parents hang out in the street. In the summer, people sit on the doorsteps and, you know, having a cup of tea or eating cornflakes or whatever. You just get to know people, and it's been absolutely amazing. So in terms of what I feared about it, some of those fears were valid, and some of them really weren't. But I have to say, there's nowhere else in the world I really want to live right now. Partly why we've stayed when we finished working there. You know, it was part of the criteria. Well, we know it's time to have a leadership one, but we don't really want to go anywhere, you know. And so we don't have any intention of moving in there because we love it. We bought a house. It's great. The kids love it. Don't they? So.
Yeah, sure thing.
Just brought up money anyway. For me, when I arrived, it was a reality check. Mm. And I think about it as a vacuum. Personally, I thought it was like moving into Peru.
Yeah.
Right? I really thought this is scary. Yeah, I've been on boozers all over the country. Yeah. I've been on the OK Road. Mm. I mean, all over London and the rest of the top list.
Yeah.
So not really surprising me.
Yeah.
And then I think just what after listening to you, and I'm thinking, my, that must have been a
Yeah, it was worse for you because you moved in next door to me. Probably too many, and it's too mixed up in my own head to articulate back to you right here. Perhaps over a long weekend of coffee, I could begin to let you into my head. And first question to do with raising up disciples, really. And the truth is, I think in society generally, but particularly in inner city communities, it's becoming easier. Evangelism, in some respects, may be becoming the easier part of the job if what you do is evangelism. I'm the jury that from that one. But if you're about getting people to make decisions for Christ, it might be that that is becoming the easier part of the job. Making disciples, which is what we're actually called to, is the hard bit. And I think it's particularly enhanced in a community like ours, which is very transient. So, people generally aren't used to having loads and loads of timetabled routine. So I was a youth worker in a church for many years, and discipleship was what I did. So I helped young people to come to faith of their own and grow in their walk with Jesus, I suppose, become disciples. If you're in a context where you're in a church and guys are used to showing up to church three or four times a week for routines of activities, they used to go to school every day, their parents will drop them off and pick them up. There's a certain amount of routine about stuff in a suburban church context, which helps you in the discipleship process. Because if you say, right, well, we're going to meet up for a youth group thing, or we're going to have one-to-one mentoring, generally speaking, they'll turn up. And if they're not going to turn up, they'll ring you and say, sorry, I can't make it this week, or they'll tell you the week before, or whatever. When you move into an inner city context, where when you're working with people that aren't generally into routines, there are many more people find routine difficult. So actually plugging into anything that is timetabled is very, very hard. And also, perhaps worse than that, people just move in and out all the time. So we had a family in our church who was a mum and four children, ranging from about 3 to 16. And they came every single week for about 6 months, and then suddenly just disappeared. So you've been on this discipleship journey with them, helping them with all kinds of things, working with the kids and with the mum and trying to help them do stuff, and then suddenly they just moved, council moved them. But for whatever reason, we don't even know, we have never, ever, ever seen her again. So your discipleship is, and when you're talking about five people in a church of 40 or 50, you're talking about 10% of your congregation just left like that. And that's happened lots and lots and lots of times. So, yeah, that's, sorry, question one, that was a non-answer to one question. The second part, reflecting back on the community that I came from, I think a lot of the church lives in the dark about what's going on outside its walls. I think we get very hung up about what's going on in our meetings and in our timetables and the way we do things. We get very het up about the way services are and what type of music we use, and we think that it's going to change the world if we're bringing a guitar on a Sunday instead of the organ or the banjo or whatever it's your flavour. Or if we have some drama, it's going to really impact the world. And I think we need to be realistic and say, unless we go to the world with the gospel and try and help people to see it in real life, in the everyday, we're wasting our time. We're just creating a slightly more funky club for ourselves. That sounds terribly cynical. But yeah, I mean, that's just one of many things I could have said. Hi, the back.
How did you move things on from kind of just getting to know folk and being involved in the community to then people actually becoming Christians and becoming members of, not members of the church, because that happened down, becoming Christian and part of it? But
I didn't catch the last sentence.
Sorry, I was just bumbling there, it's okay.
That'd be why I didn't catch it.
That was a bit. So, how did you move on from kind of going and saying, we're here, we kind of love you, you're not going to judge it, from moving from there to the point of people becoming Christians?
Well, yeah, it just happens in all kinds of different ways, because I mean, I could tell you that we have a very formulaic process in our church, which, and I could tell you what it is. You know, our idea is that we have lots of first contact points with people, so we run things like sports clubs, youth work, kids work, we've just done a big diagram of it actually for something BHQ wanted. I'm sure it's extremely important. we have lots of first contact points, we have lots of things that were taken from first contact point into more community
activity.
It's not that one. But I'm sure it's just as good as that. This is where I think our focus on our internal activities really falls down, because each individual will ebb and flow in the discipleship journey much, much, much more than any of our formulaic answers will allow for, really. So people, you know, people one day will say they're a Christian and they're in a cell group and they're fully following Jesus, the next minute they're not. And one minute they're leaving behind all the ills of their life, and then the next minute they're not. And it's a constant ebb and flow. And I'm not saying that formulaic answers shouldn't be there. I think it's good. It's good to have, for a church, to have a variety of different things in it, so that people can plug in at different points along the way and find their way through a journey of discipleship. But the only real way of helping people to become disciples is to, as Paul said, not only share the gospel with them, but our lives. That's what, you know, that's what Paul says in one of his letters, I can't remember which one, but you know, it's about sharing our lives with people. If you want to help people become disciples, we need to let them share every bit of our life as well. Does that make sense? And I think our formulas don't always allow for that, because what we end up is programmed out in church. We spend all of our time doing activities. We don't have time for people, we don't have time to know our neighbours, we don't have time to walk with them through their ups and their downs and try and share our lives with them. So, which Michael?
Yeah. Your, the guys that you worked with, like your co-workers, you said it was 16.
Yeah.
Do you reckon there was much change in them? And do you and how do you reckon the whole project changed their outcome of things?
I would say that's a mixed. I think, when, first thing, perhaps coming back to the point you made, I think 16 is far, far too many. That's one of the, on reflection, one of the things that we've done wrong, is we took too much church evangelical culture with us to the thing. So when it comes to having a, some type of church meeting, you've got 16 different ideas about what it ought to look like, and you've already made up your mind really before anyone from the community joins you. That's a real problem. So I think that's far, far too many. And people being transformed in that to different extents, different levels, probably relating to how connected they've been to the community. Because, you know, you say 16 people, but actually the reality is some of those people haven't connected hugely with the community. They live there, have done some things, they worship there, whatever, but they haven't really got involved in people's lives. Those of us, in my book, which I promise I'll try not to plug too much, but I tell some stories in there, which basically, I'll tell you very quickly the story. We got involved with a family, a little family, two people who were heroin addicts, and they had a daughter, we've been involved in their life for a long, long time, and very intensely involved in their life every single week, and for a long time. They're doing really, really, really well in lots of ways, but actually something, the relationship broke down, they walked out of our life, and we, you know, basically haven't had any contact with them for a long, long time. But I realised in the process of that, that as they walked back into their life of drug addiction and whatever else that involved, I realised that probably they had transformed my life more than I had transformed theirs, really. You know, they had walked out of our life as if, in lots of ways, we hadn't impacted their life at all. But for me, they had made just an indelible mark on me, because of the things that we'd shared together at the time, things that they taught us. And so I think, and we have to celebrate that. If we're going to be involved in the incarnational ministry, or church plants and that kind of stuff, and we're going to involve ourselves in the lives of people, we have to celebrate the fact that they will change us, and we will be transformed in the process. And not sort of set out our stall and say, right, we're coming to change everything else about this community, but actually we're coming to be changed and transformed within the community, along with everyone else. And so as everyone else becomes disciples, so do we, in a way. You know, it's just we might be a little further down the line because we've been Christian a long time, or whatever. But we're all being saved, and we're all becoming disciples, aren't we? It's all about a continuous journey rather than something that's happened in the past.
Costly but joyful.
Absolutely. Joyful. Absolutely. Both found. Yeah. Always both found.
We're going to take a break for a few minutes and grab another coffee.
Yeah.
Whatever. Run to the loo as necessary. And then we're going to come back. Gary's going to open up the word for us. Paul's going to pray for him before he does that. So thank you so much for sharing with us just now. And we really look forward to what God's going to continue to speak to us later through His words and your reflection. Praise the thanks, Gary.
Thanks.
Father, we just want to say that we love you. And Lord, we've come here this evening to hear from you. And I just pray, Lord, that as Gary speaks to us this evening, Lord, that every word will be from you.
Yes.
Lord, just encourage us. We want to be encouraged. But we're desperate to hear from you, Lord. So come and speak through Gary tonight and pray your precious name, please. Amen.
Yes, it's really nice to have that opportunity to do the questions. I think that was probably quite helpful. I don't have anything left to say now, so if you'd like to know, you had some great. Yeah, it's just nice to feel like I sort of know you all a little bit now, and you know me, so that's kind of good. It's good to be with you. This has to be one of the serious things I've ever done, during the way to start. I have a confession to make. very, very first time I've been to Scotland. So it's really, really nice to be here. Tommy's disappeared somewhere. I'm really grateful to him for coming and sharing the driving with me, partly so I can just be there when my kids wake up in the morning, so we don't have to sort of stay over this week. I'm really grateful to him for doing that. We get to chat on the matter and have a laugh on the car as well, which is great. I've been asked to speak tonight on this question that you've been looking at: who do you say that I am? Which is the question that Jesus asked Peter, obviously, and we all know that. But also, it's the question, perhaps the key question that any of us have to answer in our lives, is when Jesus looks at us and says, "Who do you say that I am?" And I've been asked to look at it from John the Baptist's point of view at the beginning of John's Gospel. So we're going to do that in a minute or two. Just by way of introduction, you heard lots about me. I've got two little ones. Our little, this microphone's sort of going on and off, isn't it?
Do I need to use it? Will that pick me up if I don't?
It should be okay. I hope it doesn't.
My little lad is he's 2.5 and he wakes me up in the morning at 6 every morning, and he shouts from his room because he's got a child safety game at his bedroom door, and he said, "Put your jacket on, Daddy!" And my jacket is my dressing gown, you know, that one. So he said, "Put your jacket on, Daddy." We go downstairs, and I sort of try to put my dressing gown on, try to pretend I haven't really been waking up. I do the terrible parent thing of putting CBeebies on. So 7:02 on the thing, on the box, and then it goes on the CBeebies, and I lay down on the couch and try to go back to sleep, and then he leaves me there just about long enough to just dozing off like that, and he says, "Take the nappy off, buddy," because he wears a nappy at night and on the day, so he comes to try my ear and I have to take his nappy off, and I sort of snuggle back down into my position, desperately trying to go back to sleep, and then he says, "I want some milk, buddy." I'm like, "Oh, right, okay, up, get off to the kitchen, get some milk, bring it back, give it to him," and then he gets back to the TV, leaves me about 5 minutes, and I'm just those who went after sleep. Neither we. So I have to go right now, pick him upstairs, because he's got no nappy on now. Of course, up the stairs, on the toilet, that's on me. Come back, it usually takes about 5 minutes for him to do a wee. So I come back down again. By this time, you know, the birds are singing outside, it's getting light. I'm still trying to get back to sleep. And then, you know, it's like, "Oh, I want some toast. Jam and toast, baby." So I'm up and downstairs, I'm down the kitchen, back and forth. And that he doesn't need to do it, but it's quite annoying, really. And I'm trying to go back to sleep. And I love being a dad, but actually, kids are extremely selfish. You know, any of you here who've got children will know that fundamentally, children are selfish. They think the world revolves around them. They think that their mum and dad, a child psychologist will back us up on this, they think that the world revolves around them and that their mum and dad are there to serve them, to bring them things, to change them, and to clean them and wash them and to take them places. That's what children believe about the world. They believe that they are the king of the universe, and you are simply there to serve them. And that's what life is like in our house at the moment. The sad thing is, actually, that's not really only true for toddlers and teenagers. The truth is that while our arms and legs get longer, some of us lose our hair and we put on a bit of weight, and we grow up, but actually, fundamentally, we still find ourselves being quite selfish people. We still believe that that we are in the centre of our universe, that if life was a page, we would be in the middle. If it was a feature film, we would be in the starring role, and everyone else would be extras and sort of, you know, having big parts. We still believe that if life was a donut, we would be the jam in the middle. We have this kind of egocentric nature as human beings that says life revolves around me, and everyone else is really here to make my life more and more comfortable. We live in an extremely selfish culture. We crave choice for ourselves, don't we? That's one of the main things that we we long for. Choice is really the premium thing that we can get in life, to be able to choose what we want to be, to choose what we wear, to choose where we live, to choose whether we're on holiday, to choose where we study, to choose what job we have, all of those things. We want to be able to choose, and that's why we do things like go to college and study, so that we can choose the best job or earn the best money, so we can choose the best stuff for ourselves. And it's all about what we can get for me, because I'm in the centre of this thing, and I've got to make my life as best I can, and everyone else can really do whatever they want, as long as I get to do what I want to do and be who I want to be. You know, Christmas is coming up, isn't it, in a couple of weeks. You know, in the UK, we will spend £156 million on Christmas trees this Christmas, something like that. We will rack up £10 billion worth of debt on Christmas, on presents, on outfits, on going out, on celebrations, on decorations, on cards, on wrapping. £10 billion, and most of that will be spent on credit cards. And most of us have no way of paying those things back, no sort of strategy or extra money to pay those things back. That is how it is. And we're all seeking after the perfect experience of Christmas because we want it to be the very, very best it can be for me, because we put ourselves in the middle of our lives and we say, I am the most important thing. I am God of my life. I am the king. I am the deity. I am the sovereign of my life. And everyone else exists around me to sort of kind of help me to make that happen. We live seeking after our dreams and our hopes and our desires and trying to go for them as best we can. And in that, we kind of, I suppose, most of the decisions we make in life are made on the basis of two questions. And the first question is, do I want this? Right? Whether it's a new car, whether it's a house, whether it's a university course, whether it's a ministry, whether it's something else in life, do I want this to happen? And if the answer is yes, the next question is, can I afford it? Yeah? I want to do this course, can I afford it? I want to buy these shoes, can I afford it? If I want to take this particular career choice, do I want to do it? Yes. Can I afford it? No, because it would mean taking a pay cut if I want to do that. We ask those two questions, and generally not too many other questions. And what I want to say about John the Baptist is he seems to have got a much better grasp of who was at the centre of life than most of us do. And if you remember nothing else from this talk tonight, I want you to remember these six words. And the first three, which I'd like to repeat after me, are God is God.
God is God.
Okay, that's good. And the other three, which I haven't forgot, are I am not.
I am not.
Okay, God is God. I am not. Okay? Simple enough. God is God and I am not. Yeah, simple enough to say, simple enough to remember. And hopefully if you all sort of fall asleep now, you'll still wake up in the morning, you'll be able to remember God is God and I am not. And that will be a very, very important lesson for you to learn. And it was a lesson which John the Baptist had learned. Just to say, John the Baptist, before I read the passage, just to give you a little bit of background, John the Baptist is this wacky creature. He's doing something that no one else is doing. He's out in the desert, he's baptizing the Jews. They're coming out of the city into the desert, and he's saying, repent and be baptized, for the Messiah is coming. That's his message. And so all these Jews are coming out and they're baptizing him. And in the passage we're going to read, it says, some Levites came to see him. Now the Levites were the descendants of the tribe of Israel, the tribe of Levi, obviously, the Levites. And their people had particular responsibility for teaching in the temple in Jerusalem. So these are like the senior teachers in the temple in Jerusalem. They're like your spring harvest speakers, you know, the main church leaders. You know, they're the DHQ staff, you know, and they're coming out to see John the Baptist, who's baptizing people in the desert. And they don't come with accusations, and they don't come to say bad stuff to him. they say to him, well, tell us about what you're saying, tell us who you are. And they're saying, are you Elijah? I mean, the Jews believe that Elijah was coming back, right? Elijah was their great prophet, so they're paying him a huge compliment. John the Baptist, are you Elijah? Have you come back? They're being nice to him. And John chooses to respond in a particular way to their questioning. And you will, if you follow me carefully through, if you've got that Bible with you, you can read it up. If not, you'll have to believe me, telling you what it says. Okay, John chapter 1, verse 19. Now this was John's testimony when the Jews of Jerusalem sent priests and Levites to ask him who he was. He did not fail to confess, but confessed freely, I am not the Christ. They asked him, then who are you? Are you Elijah? He said, I am not. Are you the prophet? He answered, no. Finally, they said, who are you? Give us an answer to take back to those who sent us. What do you say about yourself? John replied in the words of Isaiah the prophet, I am the voice of one calling in the desert. Make straight the way for the Lord. Now some Pharisees who had been sent questioned him, why then do you baptize if you are not the Christ, or, nor Elijah, nor the prophet? I baptize with water, John replied, but among you stands one you do not know. He is the one who comes after me, whose sandals I am not worthy to untie. This all happened at Bethany, on the other side of the Jordan, where John was baptizing. John had grasped something about life which we find difficult. He had managed to realize that although he was kind of this sort of up-and-coming celebrity who had commanded the attention of the senior teachers in the Temple of Jerusalem, who had all these people, hundreds or thousands of people coming to him to hear his teaching and to be baptized in the Jordan, they come to him and they say, who are you? It was like, I guess it's like a press call, you know, and he could have sort of sat back and said, well, you know, I'm John. You ought to know about me. I've influenced all these people. You might want to put my, when you write me down in the newspaper, you know, it's B-I-B-A-P, you know, spell his name out for them. And that really caught the publicity that they were offering him. Maybe he got a job at the temple and started teaching there. But he was anxious to make sure that he was not the centre of the world that he inhabited. He was anxious to say, it's not about me, this. Everything I do is not about me, it's about Jesus. It's about the one who is to come, it's about the one that you're waiting for. The Messiah is amongst you, and you must find him, and you must worship him, and you must work out who he is for yourself. So John had learned the lesson. God is God, and I am not. And now we have a challenge of working it out for ourselves. We're going to watch a little bit of video now. Thanks to Stuart for queuing this up and making it happen for me, and hope, because by the wonders of modern technology, it will appear on the screen for you now.
It's good, sir.
Pascal, il faisait tout?
Yeah, from here about a number of accounts.
You just enter your account number here, I'll direct you to a corporate officer.
Thank you.
most basic part of the plot is he doesn't know who he is, and that was the part where he finds out, my name's Jason Bourne, I live in Paris. The very first time he actually realises who he is, and the whole of the rest of the three films is him discovering what's going on in his life and that kind of stuff. And I show that because there's something about our life. Sometimes we've actually forgotten our place in life. We've forgotten that God is God and I am not. And I love that clip because he sort of finds his passport and he works out who he is and where he lives. And then actually behind all of that is a whole load of other passports, a whole load of other identities, a whole load of other things, a big pile of money, a gun and some different stuff, all these kind of different confusing messages in the background noise to his identity, which is making him really, really confused about what on earth is going on. No idea about this stuff. Why have I got a gun here? Why have I got thousands of dollars? Why have I got these different passports? I don't know who I am, or what I'm meant to be, or what I've done. And I suppose it's a bit like us. It's a bit like my son Joel, you know, bless him. He thinks that he runs the home. He thinks that he's the king of the universe and we're just there to serve him, which actually isn't too far from the truth, but he's a little deluded. And we get confused about our identity because we think that we're the king of the world, if you like. And what happens in our life is just about meeting our sort of desires and our hopes and our dreams and making them all happen. We get confused. John the Baptist is an interesting one to pick, actually, out of all the characters. John the Baptist, I think, is one of the most fascinating characters in the New Testament. Because John had it really right here. He had sussed out that he wasn't the centerpiece of life. He was able to say to the religious leaders, you know, it's not about me, actually, this is about Jesus. He's the one you're looking for, he's the Messiah. I don't want really any limelight, any praise, or anything like that. He had really got this right. He'd got it sussed, he paved the way for Jesus. And he'd really, really got it right. And you'd have thought that when Jesus came along later on and started to recruit his disciples, you know, Jesus went out to get his disciples together, and Simon and Andrew and the others, and he called them away from their nets and get them to come and follow him. You would have thought he would have gone knocking on John the Baptist's door, wouldn't you? Wouldn't you think that? So who's going to be first on the team sheet? You know, the premiership managers write their team sheet or whatever, and they put the names on. Who would be the first on the list? Well, surely the guy who's come to prepare the way of the Lord. Surely the one who's been living it out in the desert, baptizing, preparing people, would have been the first one. But he wasn't. He wasn't on the list. And then a bit later on, if you read Matthew's Gospel, it's in chapter 11, we find John the Baptist, because of various things that had happened, he's in prison. He's in the dungeons. And all of a sudden things are looking a little bit different for him. He's down on his luck, to say the least. And he sends some of his disciples, he had his own disciples, John the Baptist, and he says, he sends them to find Jesus. And I'll read it to you. After Jesus had finished instructing his 12 disciples, he went off from there to teach and preach in the town of Galilee. When John heard in prison, he wasn't one of the 12 disciples, he was in prison. When he heard what Christ was doing, he sent his disciples to ask him, are you the one who was to come? Or should we expect someone else? Interesting how he'd gone from certainty to uncertainty in the journey. And Jesus replied to his disciples, go back and report to John what you hear and see. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, those who have leprosy are cured, the deaf hear. The dead are raised, the good news is preached to the poor. Blessed is the man who does not fall away on account of me. And as John's disciples went back to him, they visited him in prison, said, oh, Jesus said, yeah, it's fine. Look, there's the deaf are receiving their hearing, and the blind are seeing, and all kinds of amazing, wonderful things are happening out there. He is the Messiah. And John says, well, that's great. I'm in prison. I'm in prison. When's Jesus come down and visit me? When's he going to come and bust me out of this place and we'll go and have some fun together? And as we know, John the Baptist, a little while later, was dead. That was the end of his life on earth. And so, it's a very weird sort of thing that's going on with John the Baptist. Certainty in the desert and uncertainty in this place of darkness and doom. And sometimes we get confused, actually, about Christianity. And I don't know why we do it, because the Bible is very, very, very plain about it. But following Jesus will be a tough life. It will bring hardship. It will bring pain. It will bring difficulties. It will bring persecution. And it will be a darn hard slog. And it will cost you everything you have. But as a preacher friend of mine often says, it will be worth it at that. We think sometimes that following Jesus, you know, it's just going to be the best thing. And we're going to have everything's going to be sorted out. We're going to get to do all the things that we really wanted to do. And we put Jesus in the middle of our page. Or we put Jesus as the jam in our donut, or the main character in our life. And we do the things that John said, and we'll have all the things we wanted. We'll be wealthy, we'll have a great job, we'll have the car that we wanted, we'll have the girlfriend that we wanted. And Jesus will just give us everything we want. And that is not what the Bible teaches. The Bible teaches that we're called to follow Jesus. And it will be costly, and it will be painful, and it will be difficult. And so, bringing ourselves to that place of saying, God, when you look, Jesus, when you look me in the eye and say, who do you say that I am? If I can say, do you know what? You are God, and I am not. Because that's the key bit, isn't it? Do you know? That's the first bit's quite easy to say, God is God. It's the second bit that's hard. It's, I am not God of my life. Actually, what I'm saying is, I give over control of my life and the things that I do, and my bank account, my money, where I live, where I study, what I do for a job, all of that stuff. I give that over to you, and I know that it may cost me dearly. In fact, we can be sure that it will cost us dearly. And lots of us, I guess, in the room, I feel there's a real sort of sense of purpose about tonight, you know. But it would be easy not to feel like that, having driven such a long way in the rain and having to sort of drive into the early hours tonight. But I really feel like there is a sense of purpose about tonight, about being here, about you being here and me being here and us all being here together. And God wanted to speak to some of you, if not all of you, about something and about things in your life where you just need to say to God, actually, you're God and I'm not. And the things that I want and desire for my life, you know, they're probably just going to have to come back down or be flushed in order for you to have what you want. And for you to have control. And for you to dictate and to drive and to guide and steer us. I know that's going to be costly. And I know it's going to be joyously painful, as even lovely, beautifully put it. Was it joyously painful? You said something like that. I know it might be those things. But I know that in the morning I wake up and I know that I'm living the way that you've called us to live. I'm doing the things that you want me to do. And, I think that's all that I've got, like 100 stories I can tell you, but I don't think I'll bother because I think God has said what he wants to say to you tonight. But tonight's about you saying, you are God and I'm not. Whether that relates to you in some sort of ministry way, that you think that God's been nagging on you about stuff that you ought to be doing and you've been choosing not to say yes, whether it's to do with college, whether it's to do with where you live, whether it's to do with work, whether it's going to be spending your money, whether what you're doing with your leisure time, how you're in your relationships, I don't know. I don't know any of you well enough to know what those things are. But I believe God will say to you, put me in the middle of your life. It may cost you everything you have, but it will be a good bargain at that. And so maybe that's what that struck a chord with you. I thought we'd just do a little exercise, actually. Well, not exercise, sounds a bit pointy. Just in response. I thought we'd just do a little thing where maybe you could find something on your person, whether it's a wallet, a bunch of keys, or I got a tissue. Keys, phone, pair of shoes, a hat, or something that represents you. Purse or something, I don't know. That represents you. And I'm just going to suggest that we bring that. You get to take it back at the end, don't worry. That you bring it and put it like on that, oh, we'll call this an altar for now, and we'll just bring it and put it and as a sort of collective representation of you. Do you know, I'm laying myself down. I'm laying myself down and saying, God is yours, and I am not. Okay? So if you can rummage around in your pockets, you have to go into a bag or whatever, don't worry about that, you know, coat. Just get some keys, something that's great for you. And if you really haven't got anything, or you can take your shoes off if you want, bring a shoe or something, anything, no matter how funny it is, or your glasses, or I don't know, anything. If you haven't got anything, I've got some coloured cards here. So you can just come and write your name or something that represents you or something God is speaking to you about on there. And just leave them here. And we'll just have a little collage, if you like, for the during the final bit of worship that we're going to do with the band in a minute. And our response time, our prayer time. We're going to just have that there as a kind of artistic installation, shall we say. And then at the end, you can obviously come and take your stuff back and no one will have stolen your money or your necklace or anything like that. So, is that all right? Do you get what I mean? Great. So there's paper here. I don't have any pens. I'm sure there are some around, but you might have one anyway. So maybe, can we just get the tunes on, or have you got some? Yeah, can you do, put a tune on? Midge, thanks. Give us a calling that is challenging, is something to aspire to, is something to look to and be challenged by every day. And sometimes we can achieve that, and sometimes we can't. Sometimes we'll be successful, and sometimes we'll be unsuccessful. Thank you that you're walking that with us, that you're walking the ups and you're walking the downs, you're walking the success and failure with us. I pray now that as we just do this simple but very personal response of bringing something of ourselves to the altar and saying, I put you on the throne, God. You are God and I am not. I pray that we'll collectively think about what that means for our lives and the things that we do, things that we say, and the decisions that we make. Spend some earphones.